Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 6, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is the presenter Rebecca Lucky. Today's session number is 98-4, and it is titled Women of Genesis, Rachel and Leah. Let's listen in.
We're going to go ahead and get started. We've got a lot of turf to cover this morning, so I welcome you again to the Thursday Bible study. Welcome to any of you who haven't been here previously in the week. My name is Rebecca Lucky. I'm a parish pastor, and I'm serving as the Bible study facilitator this week. So we have been looking at the women of Genesis. We've looked at Sarah, Hagar, Rebecca, and then today we're going to be looking at Rachel and Leah. So a lot of you talked to me yesterday afternoon, and I need to be constantly mic'd because my plan is to get these taped so that I can have your comments, not my comments so much, but I need to wear a mic all day long so that I can hear people's comments throughout the afternoon because they've been so imaginative and insightful and helpful to my understanding of these texts. And so are there any comments that we want to bring today to finish up yesterday's story before we start on today's material? You guys have it all clear in your head. You know everything, so. Okay, just a couple of things that I've put on the board. I mentioned how the story of Rachel has probably inspired more art and literature. More art and literature has grown out of this story, particularly in the Jewish tradition, than really with the other characters that we've studied. Even though I think that a lot of people from the conversations that I have had, you know, we think of Sarah as being the one that is the one we know the most about, the one that we hear about the most. Rachel, at least in the Jewish tradition, has a preeminent position. And so I put up a poem there, a Whittier poem, about that sets up the text we're going to be reading today. You need a little bit of a flow chart to follow the births that occur in the text today. So we've got color-coded who had whom and in what order. Last summer, my family traveled to France, and I had the enormous privilege of seeing Marc Chagall's work. He has done 17 canvases, Old Testament canvases, that are hanging in the Chagall Museum in Nice. And they're incredible, just the way they're presented and the light that's in southern France and the colors that he uses. It was just the most sublime aesthetic experience I think I've had in a while. So I have the postcard version. It doesn't do quite what going to the museum does. But you see a lot of the Old Testament texts that Chagall has interpreted here. And then the group that I'm missing is some that he did from the Song of Solomon. And they are all in red colors, and instead of the blues and the greens and the yellows that you see. So if you want to take any time and look at those, you can do that. Okay, when we finished yesterday, when we came to an end, we were just before the story in Genesis that if you feel at all familiar with the Esau, Jacob, Rebecca story, you probably know that story. That's not assuming that anybody's familiar with it. But the one that occurs in Genesis 20, is it 27? Yeah, where Rebecca helps Jacob scam the blessing from Isaac. And we had a chance to set that up a little bit yesterday. I know that some of you read it on your own. Again, we're tending to read, because we have limited time, we're tending to read the less familiar texts together and then send you forth to read the texts that are more familiar. But lots of interesting comments on Rebecca and how perhaps she has been interpreted a little less charitably than it's possible to interpret her. She's oftentimes interpreted as a one-dimensional kind of deceptive character. And when you read the story and you listen to what she's saying, what she's doing, this unique revelation that she, as a woman, received from God, and how that set up her actions, that there are a few different ways of interpreting her, not just necessarily the way that she has tended to be interpreted in the tradition. After this story, Rebecca overhears Esau saying that he's going to kill Jacob, and so she says, you need to flee, go to my brother Laban's house back in the old country, and hide there so that Esau doesn't kill you. So Rebecca is the protective mother to the end, and so Jacob flees toward his uncle Laban's house, and on the way he falls asleep on a rock, and he has this dream about angels ascending and descending a ladder, which that gets all the press, that part of the dream. But God tells him, you will become, your offspring will be as vast as the dust of the earth. So language that's similar to when Abraham is told that his offspring will be as vast as the stars of the heavens. I like the stars of the heavens image better than the dust of the earth image. But maybe that's saying something about the difference between Abraham and Jacob. I don't know. But so today we're going to tune in. Jacob is on his way. He's in the country now of his uncle Laban, but he has not yet met the family. So chapter 29, and we'll just proceed as we have in the past days with people volunteering to read sections and then stopping and asking the questions we've been asking. What do you notice? What could this mean? We're not wrestling for one meaning that somebody knows this, what this is supposed to mean. What do you think this could mean? Use your imagination. How do you experience God? How do you experience human beings in this text? What is the encounter that you have with God? And what do you see? There's so many truths that we know from having lived on this earth and in relationship with God about being human that just, it's like looking in a mirror in some of these texts. So, okay, 29. Let's read 1 through 20. 1 through 20. Is somebody willing to read that for us?
Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east. He looked and he saw a well in the field and 3 flocks of sheep lying there beside it. For out of that well the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large, and when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. Jacob said to them, my brothers, where do you come from? They said, we are from Haran. He said to them, do you know Laban, son of Nahor? And they said, we do. He said to them, is it well with him? Yes, they replied, and here is his daughter Rachel coming with the sheep. He said, look, it is still broad daylight. It is not time for the animals to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go pasture them. But they said, we cannot until all the flocks are gathered together and the stone is rolled from the mouth of the well. Then we will water the sheep. While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. Now when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his mother's brother Laban, and the sheep of his mother's brother Laban, and the sheep, I guess.
He saw Rachel and the sheep.
Okay, and the sheep are there too. Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of his mother's brother Laban.
Say that 3 times fast.
Pretty much Laban's sheep, yes. Anyway, then Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud. And Rachel and Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman, and that he was Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father.
Laban.
Right. As opposed to. Anyway, when Laban heard the news about his sister's son, Jacob, he ran to meet him, embraced him, and kissed him, and brought him to his house. Jacob told Laban all of these things, and Laban said to him, surely you are my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him a month. Then Laban said to Jacob, because you are my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Should you therefore serve me for nothing? There, tell me, what shall your wages be? Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were lovely, and Rachel was graceful and beautiful. Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than I should give her to any other man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of the love that he had for her.
Okay, there's a lot there. What jumps out at you?
What's the deal with the rock and the time of the day and the well?
With
a lot of time on the well.
Yeah, lots of details about the well. We've talked about wells before and their preeminent place in the community and the culture. Specifically, you mean what was he doing?
And you're talking about there's some special way you're supposed to, they couldn't feed the sheep yet. It seemed like the wrong time to water the sheep, yet they're saying we have to do it now, and there's some group effort to move this stone.
Exactly. You know, I am unfamiliar. I would like to do a whole bunch of research on the place of the well. Just from a literary point of view, what it appears to me is that it's pointing out to us that Jacob moved this rock by himself. That he saw Rachel and the sheep and suddenly moved this rock that we've been told took a lot of men to move, and that they only moved it once when all the flocks were there, so that they only had to move it once and then move it back once. So I think there's a lot of effort being spent in the story to tell us that this is a big deal to be able to move this rock. And so Jacob, out of whatever sense overtakes him when he sees Rachel and the sheep, moves the rock.
Chivalry.
Chivalry, yeah. That's what it's kind of, when you read these stories too long, you wonder now, was it the sheep that overcame him or was it Rachel? I think it's Rachel, but the way that we're being told everybody was kind of looking at everybody else's possessions, you know, you think, oh, he loved those sheep. But yeah, that he saw Rachel, and this story is unique in and of itself. We are not told stories like this about men and women, where what we perceive as a modern sense of romantic love overtakes somebody. Samuel Dresner, I recommended his book Rachel, and it's in the bookstore. He says that this is the only account of a romantic kiss in all of Hebrew scripture. So,
but was it a romantic kiss, or was it a kinsman's kiss? Or it'd be hard to tell.
How do you read it?
Well, when you read it first, it seems like a romantic kiss, but then it also fell within the parameters of a kinsman's greeting.
Well, you're not told that he greets Leah that way, though, are we?
Well, also...
Well, she wasn't the initial greeter of his arrival in that country, and Rachel was.
Well, it's just the opposite of the Rebecca story, where she puts her veil on and extreme modesty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although Rachel is not active in this story yet. She's active with the sheep, but in terms of that exchange, Jacob approaches her, right, and kisses her and weeps. Yeah.
I guess later when it says that he was in love with Rachel, too, that maybe mm-hmm. you put meaning into the kiss that you wouldn't if... Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you didn't know that he loved her.
I probably have been heavily influenced by Dresner's reading of it, where he differentiates this from other types of kisses.
Would the Hebrew tell us anything? Is there any distinction between one kind of kiss and another in Hebrew?
Not in this particular... This would not be set aside as a kinsman's kiss in the Hebrew any more than just what you see here. Yeah. What do you make of Rachel and her... What is her job?
Tending the sheep.
She's a shepherd, isn't she? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rachel is a shepherd. And sheep play a very important part in this whole story. We have been talking a lot about characters and whether they have voice or no voice, whether they have name or no name, whether they seem active or passive. And we're really seeing that stereotypic understanding of the male characters as being active and the female as being passive breaking down, aren't we? We saw it, I think some of you commented how at the times in the story of Abraham, he was such a passive character in the whole dealing with Sarah and Hagar. And now, just this morning, somebody said, boy, as we read this story, Jacob just seems to become, he becomes more and more active in terms of procreation, but passive in terms of really seeming to have any voice in the story for a while. So, and here we see Rachel, even though she has no voice at this point, she has an active job and an important job.
Is that unusual for women? I mean, are you saying that it would be strange to have a woman?
I don't know if it was strange. I think that we write that out of our reading. Mm-hmm. I think that we, when I see her referred to as a shepherdess, I think, well, why was she a shepherdess? She was a shepherd. I mean, she was one who cared for sheep. But I think that in our perception, it's so rare to have, we think of it as being so rare. Whether it was rare or not, I don't know.
Well, they don't usually mention what the women do anytime. Mm-hmm. It seems like they only mention it when maybe it's a little out of the ordinary, like Moses' wife was a shepherd mm-hmm. Before he met her. So they kind of mention it. Mm-hmm. It seems like maybe it's different than...
Yeah, it might be. Or the fact that we've got two, right, that we can think of right there. Maybe it's not unheard of that women tended sheep.
Well, did Laban have sons? If he didn't,
then she would tend them. Mm-hmm. At this point in the story, we don't know. I actually can't remember if Laban has sons or not. But later on, when they're fleeing, we may hear if they have brothers that go out or not. I can't recall that.
Weren't shepherds sort of the lowest of low? Now, I know that the sheep play a big role in their possessions and so forth, but it seems to me that I've read or heard or been taught that, at least in the time that Jesus was born, that the shepherds were really considered sort of the lowest of low.
By that time, that was more true than in this time. This early on, I wouldn't say shepherds held an exalted position, but they definitely were, I mean, they were in charge of what was the family's economic livelihood. So you're right, by the time that we get the story of the shepherds at Jesus' time, they were more of an outcast group, literally smelly and living on the outskirts of town. But at this time, it wasn't so much that case. I mean, Jacob becomes, a sheep tender. But he's an owner in a way that Rachel wasn't. But anything else you bring from that story, you glean from that?
Is there any significance to the relating of his mother's brother, Laban? I mean, it seems to me if they're going to emphasize it so much, there must be some significance.
I think there is. I think that familial tie is important. I think it also harkens back, those of us who are reading this, when we hear that again and again, mother's brother Laban, we remember the story of Rebecca and Laban, and Laban's gray character, how we didn't quite know what he was up to in terms of receiving all the gifts and sending Rebecca off. And remember when we read that story, you were here, I think, weren't you, when we were reading the story, that we weren't quite sure what Laban was going to be like. He was a character that could be read either way. And so I think that whether or not it was intended that way, it works that way in us. We keep hearing, oh yeah, this is Rebecca's brother. Oh yeah, I remember that story. So it works on us in that way, I think. Yeah.
The women who tended sheep oftentimes were preteens. I wonder the ages.
Yeah.
I mean, 7 years isn't too much if this kid is 12.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Given what we know of the culture, we can assume that these unmarried women, especially because it doesn't seem to be yet a scandal that they're not married, that they are just probably just post-menstrual if they're not married and are of marriageable age. So, anything else there?
It's interesting, this description of the two sisters. My Bible has, Leah had weak eyes.
Let's say something.
But Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful.
Yeah, and the person who read that? Yours said lovely eyes, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the same word, and it's a very strange, you can tell we brought that up this morning too. We don't think of these words as going together at all, do we? Lovely and weak.
in terms of describing somebody's eyes. It's a strange Hebrew word, and it's very uncertain what it means in the Hebrew. I think the word that I have attached to it that might capture a little bit of it would be the word limpid.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that word can kind of go either way, and I heard it attached to describing people's eyes before. Limpid pools of.
I guess for me, and this is NIV translation, for the word but there, it's like contrasting these, it's setting up the story, you know, about these two women. At this point, we don't know what Laban's going to do. But.
So it's trying to contrast Rachel and Leah in your reading because of the but. So Rachel was something that Leah was not.
Right, Leah had weak or lovely, you know, beautiful eyes. Mm-hmm. But Rachel, you know, boy,
she was something else.
She was really something else.
Yeah. If they were dressed in veils, we don't know exactly how they were dressed, but if they were dressed and had a veil, eyes would be the part that you could see, right? We get a lot of comments on people's eyes in the story.
One of the things I was wondering about is Jacob taking over the operation of the well. I mean, here's this person coming into a land that's probably has an established way of doing things, and then he's coming in and he's criticizing how it's operating the right way and changing it.
So something about Jacob is revealed to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some domineering or something.
Some kind of quality.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good thing to notice.
And the same thing later, he says, you know, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel. He's making the terms. Mm-hmm. Or maybe is that appropriate to serve that long for a beautiful young girl? Or,
yeah, I don't know what the customs were, but you're right. He's the one that, although Laban does approach him and say, just because we're related doesn't mean that you should work for me for free, but Jacob sets up the terms. Yeah. Let's continue here to see what happens. Let's read 21 through 30. Somebody read that for us.
Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife that I may go into her, for my time is completed." So Laban gathered together all the people of the place and made a feast. But in the evening, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah to be her maid. When morning came, it was Leah. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? Did I not serve you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me?" Laban said, "This is not done in our country, giving the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week with this one, and we will give you the other also in return for serving another 7 years." Jacob did so and completed her week. Then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel as a wife. Laban gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel to be her maid. So Jacob went into Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. He served Laban for another 7 years.
Okay, I hear a lot of reactions to this. Can you share some of them with the group?
Like he couldn't mention this sometime in 7 years.
Yeah. 7 years to tell me this wasn't the custom.
Yeah. How to figure out in the morning.
People are deeply suspicious of that, aren't they? Well, if we take that as an actual innocent question, these are some possibilities. And I'm not saying that it is an innocent question. Perhaps she was heavily veiled. She didn't speak. There was no light, exactly. Perhaps there was a lot of wine in the celebration of the union. And also, this was the most creative interpretation I read one time, that people didn't have glasses and contacts then. They were actually nearsighted.
So it was more than just Leah that had weak eyes.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add, too, that there's
throughout literature, you can see it in Shakespeare.
Oh, I know, I know.
In the romantic literature, this is a really common trope where the guy wakes up and goes, wait a minute, this is the woman I thought she was.
Exactly, that happens in Shakespeare all the time, and it drives me nuts, where they can't see each other, you know, because they have like a 2-inch mask on, and they can't see who it is. Oh, it's frustrating. That's why I can never watch Mr. Magoo. I just wanted him to open his eyes. It's crazy.
My mother is, where is Rachel when this is going on? And is she, at this point, I'm feeling like, my interpretation was that Rachel also loved Jacob, although I don't know that we're actually told that.
We don't know that, do we?
But is there a big wedding feast going on, or was this something that happened quietly? Was Rachel aware that...
No, this would be a wedding feast, and that's what the week refers to. When it says, finish your week, finish the week of the ceremony of this marriage before I will give you Rachel. So it's not that, I think, how many of you, if you learned the story at some point in your life, especially if you were young, like in Sunday school, thought he worked 7 years, got Leah, worked seven more, got Rachel.
Yeah.
There was a week in there, and then Rachel was given to him. And then he worked the 7 years off for what he owed on Rachel. I'm just going to use the language. It's brutal. I mean, it's that's what's happening.
They're passive. They're just, yeah, something you earn.
Yeah.
She has no say. We don't know at all.
Yeah. They don't.
I wonder about Leah, too.
Exactly.
Why didn't she say something to Jacob?
Well, why didn't, what, let's answer that question. Why wouldn't she say something?
She was the oldest sister.
She was in love with
him,
too.
She could have been in cahoots with Laban.
Or it just wasn't done. This was how it happened. This is what happened at that
she's
time.
She's not married. She's the older sister. Yeah. And women, they didn't really have a place if they weren't married. So, I mean, this is...
Well, and she hasn't, in the text, literally, neither one of these characters have come into their voice. They do, which is the reason you have to keep reading these stories. But at this point, they're not. I mean, when they end up fleeing Laban, you know, and Jacob is seeing their, asking for their, consent is too strong a word, but he's checking with them. He's discussing with it. We need to leave. And they're like, hey, our dad treated us like commerce. We have no problem going with you. So they do come into their voice, but here they don't have it. My heart immediately goes to Leah. What must this have been like for her? And how is she here, you know, standing with so many women through history who have had not this exact experience, but been powerless pawns and voiceless pawns in all kinds of economic maneuvering? If any of you have any of you read parts or all of Walt Wongeren's book, The Book of God, where he does a novel approach to scripture, and his chapter on Leah is well worth reading, or his pages on Leah, because I think it's in that book, or did he do it independently? I think I read it in a journal that had been taken from that book. I may be wrong, but I think it's in that book. And he gives Leah a voice, and he describes this experience. And it's very imaginative, and it's very tender and poignant. So if you get a chance to read that, even if it's on a library shelf somewhere, it's an expensive book, although it is out in paperback. It's worth reading, because he does what I desperately want to do, which is give her a voice, you know, have her speak and be able to say, wait a second, this doesn't feel good at all, you know.
It also seems to me that Jacob should have anticipated this, because that would be the custom, that the oldest daughter always gets married before the younger.
So again, Jacob is appearing a little...
He's a little naive.
Yeah, naive or him or something here. Yeah.
He's not thinking about it.
Yeah.
But if we go beyond the literal reading, I mean, the 7 years seems to be so significant because it's the time of completion, right? Mm-hmm. It's the 7 days to creation, and it's the 7 years to earn the bride.
Yeah, whether or not it was literally 7 365 day years, we have no idea, but...
Mm-hmm. And if Leah spoke up and said something, then she and Rachel might not have a chance to get out.
Yeah.
No, leave and go.
Who knows?
Yeah. if we tell him now, he's just going to take off and go. Where are our chances of getting out of the sheep?
So again, they're looking like Rebecca wants to get out of the town. Maybe they want to get out. Maybe this was just a really awful place to live. We don't know. This is the same place that all that occurred with her. Okay, let's keep it. Are there any more comments? We can keep plugging through this.
Well, just could it be that they didn't talk because they were probably really young?
Yeah.
And not like they would just have the teaching of their family, and there's no outside, you know, they haven't seen movies or
right.
books, so that they know that someone can stand up for themselves. So, because I could really picture if they're teenage girls without outside influence, they would just do what they're told.
Yeah,
to
this is it. This is what we do. Mm-hmm. This is what we are for.
Maybe you can feed them or something if they didn't go do their part with your land. I don't know.
Yeah.
But we also read this by our own culture, and if we read it in their culture, Laban was looking after his oldest daughter, because if the younger daughter had married first, maybe she would never have had an opportunity.
So he could have been looking out for her security.
Well, mm-hmm. Knowing that Rachel would be married, but without a husband in that culture, they were destitute.
Mm-hmm. So that's one way of reading Laban in that direction, which is legitimate with the words on the text.
He may have very much cared that both daughters, he cared for.
And he ends up putting them together. He arranges that they remain together.
Uh-huh.
The other option is his daughter goes this way, the other daughter goes this way. They have each other. He made it. It wasn't unusual for sisters to go as first and second wives.
Although the effect of that is that he ends up hitting them against each other.
Right.
Which they don't let rip them apart, but that's what happens. But you know, Laban didn't know that the infertility thing was going to happen. But again, we don't want to read the male characters any more one-dimensionally than we're reading the female characters. Laban still can be interpreted in different ways.
I have a question. Was polygamy the ordinary thing in that time?
You know, I don't know about ordinary. I know it was common. I mean, it was common. Whether it was standard, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But there does
it's
seem to be...
a question of money, although sheep.
Exactly. Of sheep, yeah. There does seem to be... that tradition of the head wife and the favored wife, which to me it implies that there are others too. And even remember, those of you that were here when we were reading Hagar, the words in scripture are that Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham as a wife. But her function was to bear him a son. So I think wives had different functions in that, but whether everybody was married more than once or not, I don't know.
And also whether... I think it, as she was suggesting, whether this was a wife that the person paid for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that the wife, wait, can I say now? Whether there was a price on for the woman or just given to, like Hagar was just,
given
for a function. Have to pay something for that.
Yeah.
For Hagar.
She's a slave.
Right. Like a concubine.
But it has to do with what
but
their station
like,
is.
It seems like you could get wives different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You maybe
right.
purchase some would come to you as slaves.
And then again, it's all the economic thing.
Yeah.
Where are they? What is your standing? Is it of equal power? Is it of lesser power, like with Hagar, who was already bound to the family?
Wouldn't there also be the bride price, too? Wouldn't Laban have to pay a dowry?
Mm-hmm.
So there is a
company. That would be the tradition.
Yeah.
Although it's interesting, remember how the scene where Abraham's servant meets Rebecca at the well and comes full of gifts. In this meeting that is more a serendipitous meeting, Jacob meets Rachel empty-handed. It's a direct meeting and there's no show of wealth, display of wealth before that meeting. Now if Laban remembers where the family comes from, he'll remember that it's a wealthy family.
What jumps out to me is that the 7 years he had to wait for Leah, and so it was like saving up your money and pay cash in time, but then for Rachel it was
got Rachel
a major
on credit.
Debt. Yeah. And what was going on, you know, again trying to read into, did he think, well, if I have to wait for 7 years, he's not going to wait for Leah, maybe.
Yeah.
Or maybe Leah has the personality or whatever, that he would say, I'm satisfied here, I'm not going to wait. So maybe he wanted to give Rachel right away because he thought, well, maybe he's not going to hang around 7 years.
Yeah. Interesting. Those are all interesting questions that come out of this text. Okay, let's continue 31 to the end of the chapter. We're starting to get into the bearing of the children now.
The Lord saw that Jacob didn't love Leah as much as he loved Rachel, so he let Leah have children. But Rachel wasn't able to have children. Leah became pregnant. She had a son. She named him Reuben. She said, the Lord has seen me suffer. Certainly my husband will love me now. She became pregnant again. She had a son. Then she said, the Lord heard that Jacob doesn't love me very much. That's why the Lord gave me this one too. So she named him Simeon. She became pregnant again, and she had a son. Then she said, now at last my husband will want me. I have had 3 sons by him. So the boy was named Levi. She became pregnant again. She had a son. Then she said, this time I'll praise the Lord. So she named him Judah. Then she stopped having children.
Comments on that one?
She whined 3 times, then she finally accepted her situation and praised God.
What is her motivation? What is that her motivation? Well, maybe that is the word. What is all this about to her?
She wants
Jacob's love, doesn't she? And
well,
he
must not hate her a whole lot if he's bearing children. I mean, you know.
Oh, but you know,
they
must
get together.
I mean, we have to. It's hard for us to read about that because, you know, sex at that time and sex in this time, it's almost two different animals. But
if Jacob was having success at having sons with Leah, then that also may have been his motivation. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that was fertile ground, this is where my offspring.
Yeah, and we'll see as we read in the next chapter that when she stops bearing sons, it appears that's when he stops paying attention to her.
But what I think is interesting is that it seems there's an expectation of love. I mean, I'm not sure that in most marriages, love was an expectation.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, that we're even in a story at this time where we're thinking about genuine love and affection between men and women. Seems sort of remarkable. You know, when you think of the arranged marriage, the economic maneuvering that goes on, we don't think a lot about, I mean, did we think a lot about whether Abraham and Sarah loved each other? I mean, it doesn't ever state that they do. It does state that Isaac loved Rebecca, but after they were married. So that, it's interesting to step outside the text and say, wow, this is kind of unusual.
Leah is talking here, and she gives a self-expression of women's feelings, mm-hmm. and that's new.
Yeah.
And because women are objects.
Yeah.
They are dealt with like things.
Yeah.
And now this reification stops, mm-hmm. and Leah opens her mouth mm-hmm. and tells
that's
us what she
has
means.
A voice, just like we were looking, you know, that's one of the things we were looking at. What is the voice? Whether there's voice or no voice is so significant mm-hmm. in these stories. And now she is telling us what her feelings are. And they are so, I find them so understandable. So, they're just right there, I think, whether you're male or female.
It's 3 times the same
yep.
thing.
Yeah.
Becomes even
exactly.
more possible.
Just hits at home.
Yeah. Well, even if there is an expectation of love in these marriages, she can see what he feels for Rachel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thinks that as his wife, she should have the same.
Yeah. Maybe if she weren't witnessing that, because the text goes, this. I mean, I do have a fairly romantic reading of this text. I have to show my cards on that. But the text goes to great lengths to tell you about Jacob's feelings about Rachel. That's not something we're just reading in. And the fact that it's so unusual in this body of literature makes it stand out even more. So you've got Leah's complicated, difficult feelings about this,
Maybe in part, like you're saying, because there was her sister right there, the object of Jacob's love. But, you know, we're having this dynamic set up here now where Leah has the children, but she doesn't have a love. Rachel has Jacob's love, but doesn't have the children.
I think one other interesting thing here, I was just noticing, we talked, I think, a couple of days ago about naming, and that it's Leah who seems to be doing the naming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does appear that way, doesn't it? And she gives very specific reasons. Although they're pretty loosely tied to the Hebrew in those names. But, yeah, there's a reason for each name that she seems to choose. That's an active thing, isn't it? When we looked at, you know, who named the children and how that all worked. And especially that passage, are you thinking of the time we were talking about Hagar naming
right.
God?
Right.
Yeah, that amazing passage, yeah.
I just want to say something about, we've been talking about the humans. My encounter with God in this text is it's one of the amazing encounters for me because he shows compassion on the underdog, on the unloved. Yeah. And that's one of the times that, and then added up with the other stories that we've been studying this week, how God comes to the person that is the down and out. God. Hagar, when she's fled, and you know, just each story we've gone through, it seems that God is showing compassion on the person that we can see is the one that
is less powerful,
and he shows compassion toward that person.
And it's so specifically stated, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And adding to that, notice in this text, one thing I notice is what we're told is God's action and what the people attribute to God. Again, we're told, remember how Sarah said, this is God's doing that I'm not having a baby. That same thing happens with Jacob in the next chapter. Why are you mad at me? It's God that's making you not have kids, not me. But here we're told only with both Leah and Rachel that God blesses them with children. We are not told that God keeps them from having children. But they certainly think that's the case. And I think that's an interesting point to bear in mind because I think it happens all the time. We attribute all kinds of stuff to God that may or may not be God's intention, God's design. But we're very quick to say, hey, this is God. This isn't. So we see that happening really vividly. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that impresses me is that Jacob here is communicating something to Leah that seems inappropriate. You know, if he is the father, or the husband of the two women, you know, he has some obligation to communicate love in some way to both of them, and certainly not hate. I don't know where the heat's coming from, or that's coming mm-hmm. from Rachel or Jacob, but you know, this translation says
that. But she's perceiving that she's hated.
Yeah, and that's a very cruel, manipulative kind of thing for one of those two to be projecting on her, unless she's manufacturing it herself.
At least in our understanding of what a husband-wife relationship is.
So there's some cruelty going on here, possibly. From Jacob's part, at least not a balance.
Or at least indifferent.
A dysfunctional kind of family environment.
It gets more dysfunctional. Yeah.
When I bore my children, I thought I was blessed. And I had these children. But her motive for having children, it doesn't say how she felt towards the children. Mm-hmm. She was doing it for Jacob, there's no mention that the act of bearing children was so.
So again, we're seeing another example of voiceless underclass kind of in children, aren't we? And we'll see that again in the next chapter with handmaids, where it's not just if you're female that you're the lowest form of life. These women, while lacking the privileged status that their husband had, they also had privileged status over children until these children were old enough to help in the field, and over handmaids. I mean, the
pecking order just keeps perpetuating itself.
And where are the daughters?
Yeah, you know, that's a, do you really think that this was 12 for 12 or 13 for 13? I mean, with mortality rates and, I mean, my hunch is we're having people edited out here.
Yeah.
Dinah is mentioned when Leah bears Dinah, but I think that's probably because Dinah has a story then later on. So this is the reference point to her. So let's keep going and get through the birth of all these children. Let's read chapter 30 through 1 through 13.
When Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister. Then she said to Jacob, "Give me children or I shall die." Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" Then she said, "Here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her that she may bear upon my knee, and even I may have children through her." So she gave him her maid Bilhah as a wife. And Jacob went into her. And Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, "God has judged me, and has also heard my voice, and given me a son." Therefore she called his name Dan. Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. Then Rachel said, "With mighty wrestling I have wrestled with my sister and have prevailed." So she called his name Naphtali. When Leah saw that she had ceased bearing children, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Then Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. And Leah said, "Good fortune." So she called his name Gad. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. And Leah said, "Happy am I, for the women shall call me happy." So she called his name Asher.
Okay, what's going on here? It's a competition, isn't it? For different reasons, but a competition nonetheless. Yeah. So they are pitted against one another. Any comments on that?
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, Leah's, you know, last comment, I mean, we see this progression, you know, from where she was trying to win the favor of her husband, and now, you know, she's, you know, happy for the, you know, favor of everybody else, mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, happy am I, for the women will call me happy.
Do the Hebrew names have, I mean, when it says, "so they called them," is that clear in the Hebrew that, like, Asher means...
It's loosely related.
Happy or something.
Yeah. Hebrew isn't, the Hebrew names aren't as clear as in some other languages where it just clearly is that word. Some of them are, but these names are to various degrees related to their interpretations. What about these handmaids now? Do they have a voice? I mean, they're women in Genesis. I mean, you could do an entire huge volume on women of Genesis that have no name.
They don't get to name their kids.
No. They don't name their kids. They have no voice. They themselves have a name. They have no voice, I guess is what I meant. They are bearing children for this thing that's going on between Rachel and Leah and Jacob. So they are even lower, aren't they, in the whole rigid way things are set up.
Is there much that's ever said about the baby journey on top of this sort of accounting of how well the cattle and sheep are multiplying as well?
Oh, isn't that happens? Interesting? Huh. Maybe you should work with that. You're a literature person. Yeah, that at the same time that Jacob and Laban are faring so well with the fertility of their cattle and sheep, Jacob is also faring quite well with the production of sons.
Well, it echoes back to the seeing Rachel and the sheep. And,
yeah, you know. Yeah, setting them right up together. And it certainly echoes with the whole theme of women and children as property,
right.
along with sheep and cattle.
No. Does this set up the 12 tribes of Israel, these sons? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, then, I hadn't realized this before. I mean, what's really interesting is that traditionally, Judaism is passed through the mother. I mean, it's the mother's affiliation that makes a child Jewish or not. And yet many of the women who are bearing the forebears of the tribes of Israel are in fact concubines.
Yeah, that is interesting. And who was it that added to the conversation
a day or two ago
saying that your understanding is that matrilineal thing is post-diaspora, the outspreading of the Jews, that at this time that it didn't work that way. That was an interesting comment. I'd like to read more about that. Yeah, so. Now, this gets really interesting. I think it's been interesting so far. We enter stage left, the mandrake plant that has, if any of you would like to read more about it, I've got this little, The Mystique of the Mandrake, out of a chapter on plants in myth and magic. So a mandrake is a potato-like plant that was thought to have both two qualities, not just one. It was thought to be an aphrodisiac, and it was also thought to promote fertility. So, you know, two plants in one. Both of them are, it's going to hit both of them where they want, isn't it? If this plant could help Leah win Jacob's love, this plant could help Rachel with her fertility. So let's read 14 through 21.
During wheat harvest, Reuben went out into the fields and found some mandrake plants, which he brought to his mother Leah. Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." But she said to her, "Wasn't it enough that you took away my husband? Will you take away my son's mandrakes too?" "Very well," Rachel said. "He can sleep with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." So when Jacob came in from the fields that evening, Leah went out to meet him. "You must sleep with me," she said. "I have hired you with my son's mandrakes." So he slept with her that night. God listened to Leah, and she became pregnant and bore Jacob a fifth son. Then Leah said, "God has rewarded me for giving my maidservant to my husband." So she named him Issachar. Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. Then Leah said, "God has presented me with a precious gift. This time my husband will treat me with honor because I have borne him six sons." So she named him Zebulun. Sometime later, she gave birth to a daughter and named her Dinah.
Okay. Now that's a little story you teach in Sunday school. Wow. What do you make of all that? You just continue to see the dynamics. They just keep becoming clearer and clearer, don't they?
What's going on? Jacob seems so passive.
Yeah. Exactly. That's the exact comment that came out of the 745, or whenever that was, study. Yeah, 745 study. What is Jacob doing? All of a sudden, this, you know, he's just exhausted. He can't even speak. And now, talk about finding your voice. She marches out and tells him, "You're the one. This is what you're doing." You can just see him, okay.
As long as those mandrakes, all right.
I think it's interesting that, to put this in contrast to what happened to the women earlier, I mean, now here he's becoming a commodity that they're buying and selling, and the wives are taking charge, and you know, they're kind of working together, these sisters. I mean, it's not like they're not speaking to each other.
Inadvertently, they are. Okay,
you can have them tonight, but you give me some of the mandrakes.
Isn't that interesting? It's just fascinating. You're right. He becomes they are kind of brokering him, aren't they? The other thing that just amazes me, which makes to me this not only, you know, a wonderful, the story of our faith, but just effective literature, is how I can read this and feel so, it's so humorous and so sad at the same time. I mean, this is a complex story. It exists on many levels. I can go through it and laugh, and then I think about what's going on here, and it's so sad. As Leah keeps saying, now he'll love me, now he'll love me. You know? So it's not just a beautiful, I mean, it's not just important to us as in our life of faith, it's just a beautiful story as well.
You know, the tie between fathers and daughters, what's Laban thinking through this?
He's, yeah.
This guy is running in and out of tent.
From tent to tent.
He's thinking that Jacob is quite a stud.
He knew this Jacob was blessed.
Well, I think we continually have to read it in the context of the time. Try to read this and say, if this story is happening today, you know, 150 years ago, this wasn't that uncommon in plantations in the South, you know, where the white owner would bear children with the black slaves. They had no say in it, and it was basically an economic situation.
Yeah.
You know, and to make it look like, you know, how can we judge these characters on today's moral and ethical standards?
That's very true, and that's a good point. We need to keep that in our one hand. On the other hand, it's impossible for us to read it in its times. We're not Hebrew. We're not semi-nomadic. We're not. Most of us aren't agricultural. We're not. There's. In some ways, it is an abyss that's impossible for us to cross.
Correct.
We try, and we go there as much as we can, but. We also don't want to fool ourselves. I mean, it reminds me of these cross-cultural experiences that are often required as part of a seminary education, which are wonderful. It's wonderful to go into someone's culture for 3 weeks and be exposed to it. But it was amazing to me when people would come back and now they were like this with the Navajo. You know, I am practically Navajo. I've been there for 3 weeks. You know, and in some ways, we reduce the culture by saying that we can read it through their lens. We can't. We are so far removed from it. But we can do things that help us. I mean, that's a really important point. We need to at all times be aware that we are not reading this from their culture and that this is a cross-cultural experience. So we have to hold that up all the time, but we also have to be aware that we can get there, and we fool ourselves if we think we can. Yeah.
So if we're looking at this at the big picture, isn't that one of your questions up there? How does this fit the whole God's plan?
In God's intention.
I mean, we're getting the 12 tribes of Israel. You know, we're becoming as numerous as the sands of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole personal story is furthering God's will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. God makes something of it, doesn't God?
Mm-hmm. And it's not really a model of a functional family for us yet, is it, anywhere in this?
Yeah, so that, I mean, that's a really large comment because if we approach Scripture saying what this is a handbook of rules for our life. Yeah. So these stories force us to broaden our understanding of what the Bible is. So if we just say, here's the Bible, it's a rule book for us. We are really reducing what this is about. Because it can't be that. I mean, parts of it are definitely, you know, you get the Ten Commandments they're a whole different thing than this.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
You know, I think something that really strikes me, and I guess, you know, the discussion of, you know, cultures and so forth, it doesn't really alleviate it, but the thing that really bothers me is the language that's used where Leah tells Jacob, I've hired you. And the language is that of essentially prostitution. Mm-hmm. And you contrast that actually with earlier, what we've been reading about, you know, the kiss ending, you know, with Rachel being, you know, perhaps as much of the epitome of, you know, a romantic experience. Mm-hmm. And then you have something that just seems to be so completely at the other end of the spectrum. And you see, in a way, it seems like the entire story becomes a little bit of a spiral.
Yeah, downward.
Yeah. Can I make one comment on polygamy? My understanding, even in current cultures with polygamy, including the illegal polygamists that live in the United States, that it's not unusual for Monday night to be first wife's night, Tuesday night to be second wife's night, and the only people that can alter that are the wives. Mm-hmm. The husband can't say, I don't want to go to your bed, I'm going to other bed. Mm. But if the wives say, let's swap, I'm tired, I'm on Thursday, you can have it. It's okay. Mm. And it looks like that's what's happened. They have made this.
But I think the thing that's alarming is it's not just sort of, you know, a women's agreement to do this. I mean, there's actually a transaction that seems mm-hmm. to be involved. And that's,
well, I wouldn't put that past, you know, even current day polygamists out there to say, I want it for the next 3 nights because I'm fertile. Mm-hmm. And this is what I'll do for you in exchange for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, this is a great discussion. I'm under obligation to bring it to a close. I am going to close it, however, with two verses. And then we're not even going to discuss them. We're going to come back tomorrow, and we're going to finish the Rachel and Leah story tomorrow, and then read the Dinah story briefly. We will not be doing the Tamar story because of time. There are still some really important things that happen in this story. If tonight you'd like to, or this afternoon you'd like to read A Comedy of Errors, read 30:25 through the end of the chapter. It sets up the deceit, the cheating just keeps going with Laban and Jacob, and then everybody gets in on the action. So I'm going to close with these two verses, and you take them with you. 22-24. After all of this, then God remembered Rachel, and God heeded her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. And she named him Joseph, saying, may the Lord add to me another son. I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you for your comments.